Welcome to Everything is Changing, the podcast where we explore how our world is evolving toward a more sustainable future. I'm your host, Ahmetcan Uzdaşık. Each episode, we focus on key areas driving this transformation: circular economy, ecosystem restoration, energy transformation, sustainable mobility, and water. Join us for conversations with experts, journalists, and change makers who are creating solutions for a regenerative and resilient world.
Everything is changing.
In this episode, we caught up with journalist Nitin Koka over coffee at the International Journalism Festival in Perugia. Nitin is a freelance journalist based in Japan, reporting on the intersections of climate change, human rights, and global supply chains across Asia. We talked about why environmental stories can't be separated from human stories, why Asia is central to the global energy transition, and how journalism can shine a light on injustice, even in the most difficult places. Now, let's jump into the conversation. Hello, Nitin. Welcome, and thank you for being here with us.
Yeah, great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Could you briefly talk about yourself for our audience?
Yeah, so I'm Nitin Koka. I'm a Japan-based freelance journalist, previously based in the U.S. and Indonesia, and I cover environment, climate, human rights issues, and geopolitics in Asia with a global perspective.
So what I want to ask first is that you specialize in stories that intersect climate change, human rights, supply chains, technology, and human rights. Why is it important to look at these intersections rather than covering them as like separate entities?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think from my perspective, like, there's no such thing as just a climate story or just an environment story. Every story has a human dimension. So when I started working in journalism, I was really interested in like bringing human stories to the forefront. And I thought, I think of like a story, every story there's going to be like a labor component or a human rights component or a gender, indigenous rights component. And if you can easily find those, if you're like willing to like spend the time to look for it, I think it makes the story, it makes the journalism more rich to have that interdisciplinary perspective. In terms of supply chains, like one of the challenges I faced when I started freelancing 10 years ago is that it was really difficult to make stories in Asia relevant to English audiences in the US or Europe. And supply chains was like a way to connect these stories by like linking these abuses or these challenges, deforestation or human rights abuses, to like products they consume or, you know, trade that's relevant to that country. So it was just a way, like supply chains kind of came in more as a way to like, how do I make this relevant to readers and audiences and editors to show them the importance of these stories taking place in places like Indonesia or China.
So what I feel like, Asia is often underrepresented in English language media, yet it's a critical region for climate journalism and human rights also. What drives your passion for covering this region, and why do you believe it's essential for global audiences to pay closer attention?
Yeah, at least like from a climate perspective, I believe Asia is responsible for something like 51% of greenhouse gas emissions globally. The majority of coal consumption, liquefied natural gas, LNG consumption, and petroleum consumption are in Asia. China is the largest consumer of petroleum and coal, versus Japan is the largest consumer of LNG. And you have the biggest producers in the region, like Australia and Indonesia. It's a huge population. And it's also like the region in the world where you're seeing climate emissions and energy consumption growing the most. Both fossil fuel energy consumption and also clean energy production and solar and wind. So it's incredibly important. Like, you can't really ignore, if you're doing a story about coal and you're not talking about like what's happening in Indonesia and China, you're missing the picture on coal if you just look at the US and Europe. If you're just writing about, you know, natural gas production in Pennsylvania and the United States, but not looking at like how it's being driven by demand in Asia, you're missing the picture. I think to like understand the dynamics that are driving energy, you have to look at Asia. And the second component is like a lot of decisions being made are actually happening within Asia. So if you look at coal from China, the biggest importers, importing countries that they're getting it from is like Malaysia, Australia, and Indonesia. They're not getting coal from the US, and they're not like getting any energy sources from Europe. And the same thing is true for LNG. It's coming from the Middle East, you know, Middle East, Australia, Malaysia, and it's going to Japan and China. There's not like a big component that's linking America and Europe to those supply chains. If you look at commodities linked to deforestation, such as sugar, paper pulp, also the trade is happening within Asia or within Asia and Africa and the Middle East. So a lot of the dynamics that are driving how the world is changing and how environment, sustainability, climate, energy are taking place is happening in Asia. If you don't understand the region and what's happening within the region, you're missing the whole picture. And it's not the story. You know, sometimes I think a lot of perspectives of the world still imagine things are like 30 years ago when the United States was by far the biggest economy and trade between Europe and the U.S. dominated. Most countries were exporting products to the Europe and the U.S. or North America, and that was the biggest driver of the world economy. It's not true anymore, but yet sometimes I feel like journalism thinks it's still true and misses out like what's actually, there's been big shifts in the last 20 years that have changed how we see the world and how things, you know, have evolved.
So what I want to ask now is the challenges in Asia's energy transition. You've written extensively on energy ranging from solar to coal to carbon capture. From your perspective, what are the biggest roadblocks that Asian countries face when transitioning to cleaner energy sources? And where do you see the most promising developments?
Yeah, very good question. It's hard to like generalize for all of Asia because you have a lot of countries with very specific challenges. But I think, you know, if I like really stretch it out or, you know, take out the layers and look at the core problem, you know, it might be surprising, but I think the core problem is like the lack of democratic and civil society press freedom in the region. Because if you look at like what's, you know, who controls energy sources in a lot of countries like Malaysia, Indonesia, even in Japan, like it's the large corporations that are controlling energy trade. Coal is like closely linked to like the oligarchy or the, well, even the president is a coal power in Indonesia. If you're not able to like get beyond these like levels of corruption and the kind of like the direct links between the coal industry, LNG, fossil fuels, investment from the Middle East, I think you have a really difficult time to like actually transition to like more sustainable energy sources. And even in the places where you're seeing like progress like China and Vietnam, it's very top down and it's being done at like an industrial scale by the same types of companies. So while the energy might be cleaner, the inequalities and the social structures are not necessarily better. And I worry that that's going to lead to like other problems down the line. I think you're seeing that a lot in China, in Xinjiang, with like the links to forced labor and how solar power is being used to, so how the solar production is linked to genocide and like human rights abuses in Tibet and Xinjiang of the Uyghurs. So I think the biggest challenge is like, how do you build energy democracy? How do you build like local grassroots energy systems? How do you like break out of this model and get over like the corruption and the oligarchical power that's kind of controlling the economies in different areas? Even in Japan, it's a democratic country, but the largest corporations that control and make policy makings are all linked to fossil fuel powers in the Middle East and Southeast Asia. So they're also part of the same structure, and they are the ones making decisions in the government. And it's very, very difficult for civil society, environmentalists, and climate activists to like pressure the government to shift to clean energy. And I think it's a structural problem. It's a complicated answer. I think that's what I've kind of been seeing. So we have to like think about, it's not just about clean energy technology or solutions. It's about an unequal system that is preventing genuine progress from taking place.
Amazing. So we already talked about how you mix human rights and climate journalism. I think a very good example to that is your December 2024 article, which was about how a massive solar project in China is affecting and will affect the Uyghur population living there. So I'm wondering, how did you come up with that story idea? And what was the most striking or unexpected discovery that you faced while reporting on it?
Yeah, so a lot of my reporting is like built on things I've done in the past. So I've been first covering like the Uyghur issue from a tech perspective in 2018. And it was just kind of a natural evolution that I would start looking at it from a climate and solar perspective as well. So this particular story, I'm a journalist, so I create news or create articles, but I'm also a big consumer of news. And I was just often like just seeing the headlines. And I'd seen like when there was an announcement about this project, the world's largest solar plant is being built. And I saw these articles and the first question was like, where is this project? And it actually was like quite difficult to find out. A lot of articles didn't mention where it was. Then I realized I found it. It's like in Urumqi, in the Urumqi region, near the capital of Xinjiang region. And then that was the first thing, like, okay, there's a story here, because how is there a gigantic solar plant being built in a region where for 6 years there's been widely documented human rights abuses going on? So yeah, that's how I got the idea for the story. The editors at Atmos, the publication, are very much into like looking at climate change and energy from a justice perspective. So they were very like great editors who wanted me to like really explore the challenges. I wanted to like make sure my story featured Uyghurs. It's impossible to talk to people in China. So they were, the ones I spoke to were based outside of China, but I wanted to like get their stories. They're from that region, like how it affects them. And I think one thing that did surprise me, and I wasn't very aware about, almost like a linear progression from like other exploitation in the region. So like Xinjiang has been like the biggest source of coal and LNG in the past, and mining. And for the Uyghurs I spoke to, they saw like, we went from coal, it went to mining, and then it went to solar. And they see it as like the same system. They don't see solar as something different. It's clean energy, so it's different from like a climate perspective, but like from an industrial perspective where the companies evolved, for them it's like the exact same companies. It's just a different form of exploitation and seizing land. So kind of like realizing like, you know, there's that this kind of exploitation and like natural resource colonialism has been going on for 50 years. And it's just like progressed to like a different form of it, but it's still the same companies, the same system. What really made it clear to me like how, you know, solar by itself is not necessarily better. You have to like really understand the historical, political, colonial, cultural context to understand how part of being developed. And also like I made a second surprising thing. I like looked up like other mega solar projects in China, and all of them are being placed in like other contested regions like Tibet, Inner Mongolia. And it's kind of like a repeat of colonialism, because you're like, where is there empty land and where is it easy to develop projects? It's in these land that's being seized from these communities. And it's something you see in other parts of the world. So it's not just, you know, it's this article is focused on China, but you see the same thing happening in other places where new mining projects are taking place in indigenous land, or new developments are taking place in places like Kashmir or West Papua, Indonesia. It's the same story happening again and again. And once you like kind of undercover the layers, you realize these similarities, then you make the connections. And that's what I mean when journalism being built on previous reporting, because I could not have done this story 6 years ago. I didn't have the knowledge or experience or the connections, but I did have the connections and knowledge and kind of the understanding to be able to take the story to like a broader level.
Well, my last question is, and I'm really wondering about it, while covering climate issues and human rights issues, people can be a bit disheartened, you know? Can I ask you, what keeps you motivated?
Yeah, it is sometimes disheartening. If I look back at the first piece I did about Uyghur issue in 2018 and realize it's been 7 years and that, you know, things have just gotten worse, it is kind of disheartening, because, you know, as a journalist, you want your story to have impact and make a difference. I think the way I stay grounded and stay positive and I think able to like feel empowered as a journalist is that I try to like be with the communities as much as possible. And I find if I'm with, you know, Tibetans and Uyghurs and spend time with them and kind of get to know them and their struggles, it can be you get like a contact empowerment, because they are not just, they're suffering, but they're still like fighting. And then just being around people that are suffering so much more and seeing how they're fighting makes me feel like, you know, I can continue to play my role as a journalist, because, you know, I always said, as an American who grew up in a very well-off family and like had a lot of opportunities, like I've been in a privileged position. So I've always seen a role as a journalist to be like, you know, you take the privilege I had or the opportunities I had and try to like give other people voice. So as long as I'm like giving people voice and building those connections, especially for the stories I do with Uyghurs, they're so like happy and polite to me when I write the stories, and they're so grateful. I don't feel like I've done anything special. Like, I think what they're doing is really amazing, and I'm just a small piece of it. But something about like when you do journalism well and you see the kind of reactions you get from certain audiences, like you know you're doing things the right way. You can just tell from how the good and bad reactions you get. You can see like, you know, you're hopefully internally making a difference, and perhaps in, who knows, things can change very fast. We saw what happened in Syria. No one expected that, and then in 2 weeks, you know, things have completely changed. Maybe I'm building the blocks to like other types of systemic change in other parts of the world through the very, very important role of being a journalist that kind of bridges gaps and helps raise awareness about these stories to people in, you know, other parts of the world.
Nitin Koka, thank you for your time and thank you for being here with us today.
Yeah, thank you so much. Great questions, and really enjoyed the discussion.